I'm Matt Wells, and this is your bank holiday special edition of Media Talk. This week, an online video of a G20 police assault sets the agenda for the British media. What does the tape say about reporting in the multimedia age? Plus, the BBC is blasted for bullying its commercial rivals in two parliamentary reports. Also in the podcast...
Look, Andrew Sachs, I've got respect for you and your lineage and progeny. Never let that be questioned.
Don't hint.
I wasn't hinting! Why did that come across as a hint?
Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand are overlooked, but our own little podcast is very much in the running for a gong. We look at who's in and who's out of this year's Sony nominations. And...
Feel like never before. New Durex Play O. Pleasure-enhancing gel for women. Durex Play.
I'll have what she's having. The Advertising Standards Authority says orgasms are okay before 11 p.m. All these stories and more are coming up on Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, this week, Tony Blair gave an interview to Attitude magazine saying homophobia in Britain has decreased significantly since the early 90s. With that in mind, we've managed to get two raging heterosexuals to sit on the panel. Steve Busfield is The Guardian's head of media and technology. You're notorious for your Hawaiian shirts and X's at the end of your emails. Are you absolutely sure you're straight?
Well, I am married to Janine Gibson.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that doesn't say anything, does it? John Plunkett is Media Guardian's radio correspondent. Will you be camping it up over the bank holiday weekend?
Well, can I say I'm going up Mount Snowdon, and right. I'll be giving an interview in Altitude magazine. So it's out next month.
Very good. Stephen Brooke will be joining us later on to review the week's TV news, but we're under starter's orders. Time to get going. First, to the story about the death of Ian Tomlinson. He was the man caught up in the G20 protests, you remember. You'll probably have seen the video of police shoving him to the ground shortly before he had a heart attack, not only on our site at guardian.co.uk, but on pretty much every UK TV news and newspaper website too. It led to an interesting spectacle of seeing the Guardian logo, which was embedded in the video, splashed across page 3 of the Times. Now, putting aside the many repercussions of the story itself, this is an interesting development in the evolution of the exclusive newspaper story. Steve Busfield, you're a former news editor yourself, so we'll come to you first. It's interesting that what would otherwise have traditionally have been a broadcast story was broken by a newspaper website.
Yeah, the getting of the story itself was an interesting look at the sort of new and old world of getting stories, because Paul Lewis, the reporter who got the story, spent a long time chasing it down, chasing leads, trying to find people who were there. You know, there was a lot of footwork involved, a lot of talking to people. And then the footage comes from that new era of citizen journalism where somebody in the street with a camera or a phone or, you know, whatever can just, you know, happen to catch the moment that is the crucial moment for the story. The fact that newspapers now all have websites means that we can all carry video footage, whereas in the past, if we had got that, we would quite possibly have been forced into sort of some sort of deal with a broadcaster where we'd said, we've got this great footage, we're going to write a story, we will include stills in our newspaper, but in order to get the footage shown, it would have to go on the BBC or on ITV or Channel 4.
Well, we talked last week about how Twitter was used at the G20, but as you say, now everyone has a camera, and something that would maybe otherwise have gone unreported, perhaps, is now out there for all to see, which has lines there for police accountability as well. You know, the police might otherwise have been able to continue with their line that it was nothing to do with them.
Yeah, I mean, in the old days, there would have probably been some broadcast cameras somewhere, but they would have been well away from the action. Now, pretty much everybody who's involved in the action can be a camera person if they want to. And there's no doubt that if this person hadn't been there filming it, it would have ended up being, you know, the word of some eyewitnesses against the word of some policemen, and the story would have gone away in a way that it's not likely to now.
The state that is a Big Brother with so many CCTV cameras all over the streets these days, we're actually... it's not just them watching us, but now we're watching them, and it's got to the stage we saw in that video where some of the police actually pull balaclavas over their face so they're not recognised and take their numbers off, perhaps in the knowledge that there are people with digital phones and cameras out there who will be watching what they do.
And it also speaks to an interesting tale of how the police handled the story themselves, because they started off by putting out a certain line suggesting that they had helped the guy when he was on the ground, which may or may not be true, but didn't mention the stuff that went earlier on. So when that is exposed by these cameras, and in this way, the police's own version of events is called into question.
Yes, and it changes very rapidly when you have the evidence and we can see it in front of our own eyes, whereas, as Steve suggested, in years gone by when it might have been eyewitness reports, that might have led to an inquiry or some sort of thing further down the line, but that would have taken weeks and months, whereas this was a matter of hours.
And the speed of that response also forces newspapers in particularly into interesting decisions. It was interesting to see how the response of newspapers like the Telegraph and the Mail, which are traditionally their natural instinct is to be pro-police, start to change their editorial stance as the days go on.
Well, it was pretty impossible to ignore the sort of evidence in front of their eyes. I mean, there were long debates within this building about how we were going to break that story, and, you know, and the time frame that you use, because in the olden days it would have been an exclusive in the newspaper in the morning, and the decision was made that we should put it up online in the evening with the footage when there was the maximum possible impact sort of overnight with the TV broadcasters as well, so that whilst it was a Guardian exclusive, you know, the Guardian newspaper was not anywhere near being the first person to break it. There was, you know, there was also an interesting snowballing as the evening went by about which other websites and which other broadcasters were following that story and how they used the footage. And the Mail, for instance, took a whole load of snapshots from the video and put them onto their website and put underneath it that it was copyright Guardian, but they didn't anywhere have the video, and they didn't link to the video. And you know, and it's still a process which the British media are sort of working around what the etiquette for these things is, what the accepted principle for these things is. I mean, the BBC by the following day was embedding the video, but sort of if you looked really hard, you could see at the bottom of the page copyright Guardian for the video. Some other places took off the Guardian branding and put their own voiceovers over.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess you can't stop people doing that, can you? And what I thought was interesting, actually, that for a story like this, which is often very difficult to keep any kind of control over, if that's the right word, that the Guardian continued to be recognised for this story, you know, a day or two onwards. I mean, that was quite an achievement in itself, really, to be honest, I thought.
No, absolutely. I mean, there are funny rules about the web and who has ownership of stories, and, you know, and to be perfectly blunt, you know, this is just a public interest story, and the more places it's covered in, the better, and, you know, and whether it's our story or not is a lesser factor. All the same, you sort of hope that that people will at least acknowledge, you know, the journalistic work that has gone into it, and that most people will, you know, will point at the Guardian website on the web and say, you know, this is where you see the original footage. This is where it came from.
Well, I think it works best on the web as well.
It's a web story.
That's right, and that video works best on the web too. I think when you put it on the big screen, it's naturally grainy because of where it came from. But and you click on, it's 2 minutes long. It's the ideal web video.
Steve was suggesting that it's an interesting, it's instructive in that it's a very new way, very digital way of doing a story. Broaden it out and not just talking about this particular video, but the way newspapers generally are using video to drive traffic to their websites. The News of the World and the Sun do it a lot. They always film their exclusive interviews now, or if they've got the Prince Harry doing something ridiculous in some nightclub or other. And because video is now is commercially very important for newspaper websites.
Yeah, I think the key is in sort of brevity of the video and in offering something that's not offline in the print version. And it certainly encourages me to take my video phone or video camera or in my case, a video 8 along with me next time I'm out on the road. But as long as I can do shorthand at the same time, maybe I should strap it to my head.
I mean, all the sort of news organisations, particularly the newspapers that have websites now, are sort of taking slightly different views of how they should carry video. I mean, the Times website has links to Sky News footage. The Telegraph website did a deal with ITN where they get these sort of little mini news packages. I think the view at The Guardian is that actually we don't want to replicate what you can get on TV news, because if you want to watch TV news, that's what your television's for. So we sort of, you know, we try and do things that are a particularly Guardian take on something, or here is the small clip that is the thing that you absolutely must see in video that accompanies the story.
Okay, listen, you can stay up with, if you haven't seen the video, I'm sure you have, but if you haven't, it's at guardian.co.uk/G20, and all the media implications of that are at mediaguardian.co.uk.
Media Talk.
I'm Matt Wells. Still ahead this week, we'll analyse the parliamentary reports condemning the BBC for using licence fee money to crush its competition. Now, before we go on, I'm sure you've all listened to our new US version with Jeff Jarvis. If you want to make sure that you get the next episodes of that new monthly podcast, do sign up at guardian.co.uk/MediaTalkUSA. Now, though, it's time to concentrate on some of the other media stories from the past 7 days. And John Plunkett, you get to go first. Parkey versus Jade. This is what Michael Parkinson said in the Radio Times. She represented, quote, all that is paltry and wretched about Britain today. Her death is not the passing of a martyr or saint, or, God help us, Princess Di. Where do you stand on this debate?
I thought it was quite unnecessary. I mean, I think she'd been a couple of days since her funeral when Parkinson sort of laid into her in the interview in the Radio Times. I'm not quite sure how much he added there, and I wonder if she'd still been alive and if he'd still had his ITV chat show, whether she'd have made quite a good guest on his show, and we might have learned quite a lot about the state of Britain today.
He did say, Steve, he did say that she was one of the people that he really wanted to interview only about a year or so ago.
Would he have put that to her if he had interviewed her? I wonder. Would that have been his first question? Or would he have said, I've seen in the cuts, like he normally does, in a slightly different accent?
No awards for Michael Parkinson then, but perhaps some awards for other people. Definitely no awards for Jonathan Ross, and no awards for Russell Brand, because they've not been nominated, have they, John, in the Sonys?
That's right. They weren't entered by the BBC, or possibly
they weren't entered.
They weren't entered for consideration.
Are you sure about that?
I understand so. It might well have been their production companies that were responsible, but okay. I'm sure the BBC would have had a hand in it. So they're not in the running. They were both winners last year.
Yes.
Curse of the Sonys. So yeah, we had the Sony nominations were announced by Johnny Vaughan on Monday night.
Yes. Oh, ouch. We were at that ceremony.
Hot and sweaty basement bar.
Yes. It was not a good night for commercial radio.
It wasn't. I've got the stats here.
Go on.
More than 150. Nominations, 103 went to the BBC, so it's a sort of 2-to-1 split.
I thought the whole point of the way that the Sonys are set up, with an interminable number of categories, was that to absolutely ensure that the commercial radio would get at least some awards.
It was quite... Well, Absolute Radio got 7 nominations. They went home quite happy.
The station formerly known as Virgin Radio.
That's right, yes.
As Johnny Vaughan kept pointing out in the evening.
And in fact, they only got one fewer nomination than Radio 2, so it was a bad night.
One fewer nomination. That's very good grammar. I'm very impressed, John.
I thought, should that be less? But yeah, one fewer. So Radio 2 didn't do very well. None for Wogan, none for Bruce, none for... nothing for Vine or Steve Wright or O'Leary. So, there were 10... nominations for Six Music, so they actually got fewer than their new digital sibling.
Good news for Bob Shannon, the new controller of Radio 2 and Six Music, if he's feeling in a digitally inclined mood.
Yeah, absolutely, and if he likes Adam and Joe, who got 4 nods.
Excellent.
I'm sure he does. I'm sure he'll be sitting in on their show tomorrow.
Plus, good. Of course, he can get more for Radio 2 next year, and then, you know, then he'll have been a great success.
Claim it all for his great successful reinvention of Radio 2. We ought to just very briefly mention the particular nomination, shouldn't we?
Yes, and I think this is the... the Internet Programme Award.
That's right, which is the very strong field, I felt, in the Internet Programme Award. There's an RSPB podcast, is that...
There's a Catholic diocese based in Bristol.
Yeah, well done to them. Who else, possibly?
There's Answer Me This,
yes.
comedy podcast.
Yeah.
And there's another drama and documentary podcast whose name slips my mind. But I think,
are there any other nominations in
I think
that
there's
category?
One more, something called Media Talk.
Ah, oh, yes. Now, that's a very interesting programme. Well-deserved nomination. Have you got your tuxes ready?
I got my tux tucked in.
Excellent.
I think Janine's being invited and I'm on babysitting duty.
You're on babysitting duty. Johnny, good?
I can look after myself, Steve. You go.
Excellent. Now, let's wrap up this section by a very interesting ruling from the Advertising Standards Authority this week. It says that... It says here that it says that women may orgasm before 11 p.m.
Which was news to me.
Which was... Quite frankly, I'd rather be watching Newsnight at that time. Don't know about you, Steve, but...
We think it's orgasm on television. Television,
yes,
rather than just
right.
Orgasm in general.
Yes. Now, explain the story.
There was an advert for a Durex female pleasure gel, which features lots of women looking like they're enjoying themselves, although, you know, there's nothing too rude other than their facial expressions.
Okay.
With some Mozart playing over the background.
It's all very tasteful.
All very tasteful.
I always put a bit of Mozart.
Although quite how I would explain it to my children if they happen to be watching, you know, what is going on, you know, then
yes.
That would be quite tricky. It was played on Channel 4 at 10:05. which comes before the 11 o'clock watershed.
Is there a second? What's this 11 o'clock watershed? I've never heard of this.
Well, they are changing the rules about when condom adverts are allowed to appear, which is the important part here, because they're going to allow condom adverts to appear at, I think, any time of day, actually.
Good Lord. What's the world coming to?
In a whole, you know, trying to educate people and, you know, and take them the products that they need to know about.
I'm assuming, you know, not anywhere near children's ITV.
I hope not. And the ASA
rules... I was going to say, certainly not after Rosie and Jim, but I think that maybe displays my age, doesn't it? Do they have Rosie and Jim anymore?
I haven't seen it for a while. Yeah. The ASA said that the advert was fine, even though it was at 10:05. And that the advertising industry says that this shows that they can be responsible when it comes to advertising important but delicate matters.
Right, absolutely. Well, I think we're shown how responsible we are in covering important but delicate matters. That'll do for now. For more on all these stories, go to mediaguardian.co.uk. Now, a pair of parliamentary reports into the future of the BBC came out this week. The first, by the Culture and Media and Sports Select Committee, said the BBC's commercial activities, ostensibly under its BBC Worldwide wing, should be seriously reined in. The second report, by a Communications Select Committee in the House of Lords, recommended that part of the licence fee should be redirected to help regional programming for the BBC's commercial rivals. Now, they're part of the ongoing, actually make that never-ending, public service broadcasting review, and apart from anything else, these reports seem to finally put the kibosh on the proposed link-up between BBC Worldwide and Channel 4. At least that's the view of some people. Steve, what do you make of this? The commercial report is particularly interesting in the light of the Lonely Planet deal that the BBC did a couple of years ago, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they're basically saying that that what I think the rest of us have always thought, which is that BBC Worldwide is there to commercially exploit things that the BBC does, and that going beyond those bounds and sort of, you know, setting up commercial territories that they weren't already in is, you know, is not what BBC Worldwide is there for. Interestingly, it also came out at that point that the Lonely Planet deal was £118 million, which I think was about £40 million more than anybody had previously thought. I think it's interesting that you say that these might have put the kibosh on the BBC Worldwide Channel 4 tie-up. I think it's probably more likely that other things are going to put the kibosh on that. I think the fact that the BBC doesn't really seem to want to do it is probably one of those.
Probably one of them, yes.
The fact that Channel 5 and ITV both think that they're much more likely and better partners for Channel 4, and they will kick up a fuss if a BBC tie-up happens. I think that will put the kibosh on it. And then finally, I think there's the fact that whilst in Media Talk and Media Guardian world and, you know, and Ofcom and Stephen Carter's world, you know,
This is Digital Britain.
Yeah. That, you know, that there is an enormous impetus to sort out the problems of Channel 4 and sort out the problems of the media and, you know, what we're going to do about financing. And whilst Andy Burnham is talking a good game and Stephen Carter's talking a good game, I think actually the fact is that, you know, Gordon Brown's got an election next year. He's got bigger problems to worry about. And how likely are any of these problems to be solved in an incredibly short time frame that, you know, that we seem to have upon us? So we may well see. You know, none of these problems being solved, none of these deals being done, and the Tories coming in, and how high up their agenda will
it be? I don't know about you, John, but I think that's a bit unfair. I think contestable, for the idea of contestable funding is right up there at the top of the electoral agenda, don't you?
I think it's the phrase on everyone's lips. I think it made a lot of sense reigning in Worldwide. I can see the point of them exploiting shows like Top Gear and distributing shows overseas. But you know, the Lonely Planet deal and buying shares of independent producers, I think, is going a step too far. This is a step too far too. I went to Land's End last week and I was greeted by an enormous concrete shopping centre, in the centre of which was the Doctor Who experience. I didn't go to the end of the world, or at least the end of England, to see a cyber frog or whatever it was that was jumping up and down. But the people around me look very distressed.
I've been there. It's a tatty old place.
Is Johnny Groats the same?
No, I haven't been to John O'Groats, actually.
I wonder if they've got a concrete fun park up there, too.
A better class of the end of the world in Scotland.
Primeval.
Yeah. Well, we'll come to that in a minute. But don't talk about my favourite TV show, Adam. Now, from the blog, this is what Lonely Sven said. This proposal would reduce the programming budget for the BBC. To make up the shortfall, they could sell rubbish like Casualty and Strictly Marketing Lloyd Webber to ITV and just repeat some of its decent drama and documentaries on a Saturday night instead of burying them on BBC Four where nobody watches them. Instead, they could show them on BBC One where nobody would watch them either. That would be a great idea, wouldn't it? Treetop Squash would say it's just the latest and the usual. The BBC is far too big for its group's carping from the usual suspects, including, of course, the Guardian Media Group. Wouldn't we all be happier if the corporation was just that tiny bit more useless at what it does? Isn't it useless enough already? If the iPlayer wasn't quite as user-friendly, if the BBC's light entertainment drama departments weren't quite as good at grabbing ratings from its rivals, if the BBC weren't worldwide, didn't make quite as much money, and if it wasn't quite as committed to covering the regions. There's a bit of a point there, isn't there? That there is carping constantly at the BBC. How shit would we like the BBC to be?
Well, I mean, it's true there is constant carping at the BBC. I think most of it comes from other media organisations in this country that have an agenda, and I would say...
GMG has got an agenda.
We do have an agenda, but I also think that as an organisation, we probably support the BBC more than any other. And actually, part of the point of this is that we absolutely uphold the right of the BBC to be funded in a way that is, you know, there's slightly anachronistic in this day and age, and to do the things that it does spectacularly well and to continue doing them. The point is that, you know, that they're going to make it trickier for themselves if they aren't whiter than white. And, you know, this just took them into an area that perhaps wasn't a sensible area to go into.
Do you think, John, that the BBC will be forced to sell Lonely Planet one way or another?
I guess if it does, it's going to be for a lot less money than the 180 million quid that they spent on it. Yeah, so
troubles all round then. Great
lonely accountant.
Yeah. If you want to have your say on this story, do post a comment on our blog, usual place, guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Stephen Brook has joined us for the final segment of the show.
Intense discussion on the podcast, which I've not yet heard, but I'm assuming that's the case.
Why?
Well, because, you know, in our grand new studios, there's actually a walkway through. I was doing ballet leaps across, and none of you noticed.
Okay,
trying to get your attention to disrupt proceedings. I dismally failed.
I have my back to the glass, fortunately.
I haven't got my glasses on. And I was concentrating very hard. Maybe we were talking about orgasms at the time.
Probably we were. Yeah, we were. Yes, it was a very intense discussion earlier.
It was hands on.
I should explain to listeners that Stephen Brook is 70s porn star chic today. You've got a sort of...
Surely not my Guardian lanyard.
No, I'm talking about that sort of velvet thing that you're wearing.
Oh, right? Okay. I think it's cotton, but it is brown, so I guess that is 70s porn
and
star.
And it's figure-hugging.
It is figure-hugging.
And right. I've got the body for it too, Matt, you were going to say.
You could say that. I can possibly comment. I was going to ask you about, talking about dinosaurs, which we weren't, the debate between, that has been raging this week, Saturnat television. In your house, is it Primeval or Robin Hood?
Primeval.
Oh, yes.
Of course. I think that I've been an occasional viewer of Primeval once I got over. It took me about 2 years to get over the fact that it wasn't Doctor Who. But I think it's fun, and they had a marvellous episode the other week set in the British Museum that looked fantastic. It's all a bit of silliness, but in its own way, gripping.
The trouble is Robin Hood takes itself too seriously, doesn't it?
Yes, I thought they had they got the tone totally wrong when they started all that sort of I'm coming back from war. It's a metaphor for the Iraq war. You just need it. You know, it needs to be over-the-top silliness, and I think that they've misstepped from the very beginning.
You've got the patter of tiny feet runs across the Busfield household quite a lot, so that it must be an epic issue in your house. Or are they not old enough yet?
They're not quite old enough. I've been quite scared by Primeval. I certainly wouldn't put my children in front of it yet. But the view on the Organ Grinder blog
amongst
our readers, well, yes, but I think it was leaning towards Primeval.
Right.
I think there was a general view, sort of backing up what Brookie says, that Robin Hood is a little bit too serious. That the best thing about Robin Hood is Keith Allen and, you know, and his one-liners, but actually that's not necessarily what is going to be enjoyable for a family or younger audience.
Well,
and then actually, you know, Primeval was, you know, a bit daft, but quite a lot of fun.
A couple of good one-liners doesn't save a show, as we have learned on Media Talk. what's been happening in EastEnders this week?
Oh, EastEnders, Jacques. Complaints have been flooding in to the regulator Ofcom on two very diverse topics. Actually, I'm going to throw to John Plunkett now to discuss the very serious issue of, well, you tell us what's been happening, John.
Well, a bit of gingerism, which is not a dental issue. But, yes, there are lots of complaints that one of the youngsters in the show had said to, now, was it Dottie talking to Lizzie, or was it Lynette talking to Dave? I forget, but she said, hey, you know why you're not going to get married? Because you got ginger hair.
That's outrageous discrimination.
There were tears up and down the country.
How many complaints for this one? How many thousands?
We think it was three figures, at least. And some of them from
and people, some of them weren't ginger.
Yeah. That's right. The BBC pointed out in a slightly po-faced response that there are several red-headed characters in EastEnders, and they're all happy in their own way.
What is going on this week? Gingerism in EastEnders and dentalism on from Claire Balding on Grandstand.
Yes, yeah.
That's another outrageous one as well.
I think Claire Balding is a good presenter, but if you do a lot of live television, sooner or later you're actually going to put your foot in it, which she did, and she's apologised, but this is the modern era.
We should explain. She asked a jockey whose name, I have to say, excuse me, to...
The one that won the Grand Nationals, the easy shorthand way to describe him.
She asked him to open his mouth.
Yeah, just after he'd won, and she was doing the big post-race interview.
Yeah.
Which he kind of refused to do, and she said, go on, because he doesn't have the best teeth,
no.
And so all 8 million people
She was trying to make the point that he could afford to have his teeth done now. It was just one of those things, just you think she should never have gone anywhere near that.
It was never going to come out the right way, and she's, I think her reputation suffered a bit. The other EastEnders scandal, which has generated about 50 complaints.
We could link these two. There's a joke here that links these two things.
Well, I should say the horse was furious because it thought Claire Balding was talking to him.
I was going to make a comment about gingivitis, which is, of course,
much better.
A dental, you know, disease. Where were we?
EastEnders again.
Yes. No.
Well, you know, the common complaint about EastEnders is it's too doom and gloom. But there have been complaints to Ofcom on this very topic because, you know, Danielle, who was the bright young blonde teenager, appeared and then turned out to be Ronnie's long-lost daughter and immediately got mown down by a car being driven by Janine. Well, anyway, if you don't...
Janine?
Yeah. But
not my Janine.
But what's Janine got to do with this?
This happened last week and about 50 people
have complained. That's why she's not in the office today.
About the whole incident, about EastEnders being too much of a downer.
Well, I'm sure Ofcom will be, you know, investigating.
Well, I want to make a separate complaint because if you've watched the show before, you'll realise that back in 1986, Andy, on his way from the shops, got mowed down by a car in similar circumstances.
It's a very dangerous area, Walford.
As did Tiffany when Frank mowed her down in a car.
Yes, you're right.
A few years back. So my complaint is they're recycling old plots. Must okay. try harder.
Okay. Now, Brookie, in previous episodes of this podcast, you've introduced us to obscure programmes that... Gems, digital gems.
Mm.
Ladies with Letters.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you very much. I've been watching that. You've got a new one for us.
I do. And this is one for all those people out there who got their start in media in a very menial, low-paid or, in fact, no-paid kind of job. This is a reality TV show out of the States called Running With Heels, which is about Marie Claire magazine and its editor, Joanna Coles.
What channel is this on?
This is on Sky
Channel 253?
Yes.
Yeah, Sky 253, a channel called Style Networks, which I think has never previously crossed the consciousness of anyone in the UK.
But the key point here, you've just mentioned it, and I talked all over you, as usual, but you mentioned the editor of Marie Claire is...
Joanna Coles.
Former media correspondent of The Guardian.
Yes, and former New York correspondent of The Guardian and also The Times.
Yes.
So there's been a sort of wise nodding whenever her name has come up in dispatches around the office.
Yes.
So she is part of the program, but then they have these three interns who basically are set up against one another for possibly a job on Marie Claire. So it's a bit of Devil Wears Prada, kind of you've got to run around and get the editor's dry cleaning. etc., etc., etc.
Well, I'm going to put that in my Sky Plus. Thanks, Brookie. Another winner.
Thank you very much. Is there anything else? I mean, we haven't discussed The Apprentice. We're not going to. It's an apprentice-free week this week.
I think in danger of losing it, I thought.
Yeah, possibly.
A bit dull this week.
I watched an episode of The Wire this week, which is very exciting because it's the first ever episode of The Wire I've ever watched.
Was it Series 4, Episode 6?
I thought it was rubbish.
I couldn't understand a word.
I didn't watch The Wire, but I did look through a copy of Wired magazine. So right. Does that make me in any way cool?
I also watched an episode of Mad Men, which I'd never
seen. Oh, yes.
Thumbs up. But I don't feel confident to talk about any of these matters yet. I need to watch at least another 140 episodes of each before I'm qualified at The Guardian to talk about these episodes.
Can go onto the Wired blogs, there's about 1,000 of them, or Grindr to talk about Primeval or Running with Heels.
Thank you very much. We've been given the signal to wrap up and pack our bags. So to have your say on any of our topics from this week, go to guardian.co.uk/mediatalk or post a comment on our Facebook wall. My thanks to Steve Busfield, John Plunkett and Stephen Brook for making Hay While the Sun Shined. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. He's also doing our new business podcast too. So please make sure you check out that and our other fabulous podcasts at guardian.co.uk/audio. I'm Matt Wells. See you next time.